So then, what did you had cores, you said 70%, 75% of the market. What did you think you needed to do to introduce Budweiser?
Well, what happened after in 1970, the other distributorship in that had all the other brands other than the Budweiser brands and the Coors brands, there was Miller, Pabst, Schlitz, Lone Star. It was another wholesaler that had those, a man by the name of Frank Drum from Fort Smith, and he also had the Tulsa distributorship. And we were able to negotiate a deal to buy his distributorship in 1970, and that took us up to the point where we had enough business to survive. The first year I got in business, we sold 20,000 cases, and our margins were about 60 to 70 cents a case. So by picking up these additional brands and a warehouse in Bartlesville behind the old ice plant, we were much more efficient, and we got our volume up to about 75,000 cases a year, which enabled us to survive the onslaught of the Coors brand. What's kind of interesting, the end of the Coors territory was Kansas and Oklahoma, and there was a lot of bootlegging going on. And the bootleggers from Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi were coming to Oklahoma and buying the Coors beer, paying cash for it. And the Coors wholesalers were selling it for wholesale plus $2 or $3 a case cash. And this beer, we figured 15% of the Coors beer that was reported sold in Oklahoma was actually going to those other states. And the Coors Brewery got wind of it, and they went around and told these wholesalers that they would cancel them out if they caught them shipping beer out of their warehouses to these other states. So after that happened, the bootleggers would have to come to retail stores to get their beer. And one of the biggest outlets was West Siloam Springs, Arkansas, or Oklahoma. The trucks would come into West Siloam Springs in Oklahoma and pull up in the front door, and the Coors truck was in the back door, and the beer would go through the store, through the retail store, and then it would go on into those other states. And of course, Coors couldn't do anything about that. And what happened, beer didn't get rotated in these other states, and so the taste kind of got bad. So when Coors expanded into these other states, their sales weren't as strong as they thought they would be because they didn't have the image, the mystique. They went into states like Missouri. In Columbia, Missouri, they had Dan Devine, the ex-football coach, is the wholesaler. In Missouri, Nebraska, South Texas, they had their wholesalers build the warehouses and trucks for 10% of the business within 2 or 3 years, and they never got to 5%. So a lot of those wholesalers, Coors wholesalers, went broke and had to sell out to other wholesalers. And that happened to Bob Lilly, the football player, Dallas football player that had Waco. He sold out.
But isn't it true, to introduce Coors, you got the college students buying Bud. That's one of the ways you're going to compete with Coors.
Oh, what happened? The Coors in 68 was being sold in a 11-ounce can, and it was less expensive. The wholesale price of Bud, Miller, and Schlitz were in 12-ounce cans at $4.85 a case wholesale, and Coors was $4.45 wholesale, and it was priced cheaper in the stores. And the consumer thought it had this premium image, And they thought it was a better buy, but they didn't realize 24 11-ounce cans, they got short two cans on every case they bought. And then Coors came out with this new filtering system and everything where they wanted the beer to be cold all the time, and they were trying to keep everybody have it cold in their stores. Of course, at first, you couldn't keep it cold when it was in the early 70s. They'd bring Coors into the liquor stores, and it was sweating because it came out of controlled temperature warehousing. So Coors went to a 12-ounce can in the 70s, and they raised the price to $4 wholesale price to $4.60 a case. And Bud, Miller, and Slitz were, like I said, $4.85 a case. Well, the vice president of Budweiser in Houston was in St. Louis, and he got Gussie Bush to lower the price, wholesale price, 25 cents a case, down to 460. So it went to 460, and that, along with Slitz and Miller, they followed. So all four brands were wholesale price the same, and they ended up the same in the grocery stores and convenience stores. Well, then the long neck Bud, or long neck beer, let me put it that way. Budweiser, Slitz, and Miller were in long necks, and they were returnable bottles. Coors was in a short neck bottle, and so it had a different image. And the college students started liking long neck bottles because of the country and western songs and everything. And in the bars in Norman and Stillwater, they were drinking long necks, and Coors had come out with a long neck also. And when the students were leaving, they were throwing these long neck returnable bottles into the trash cans, and the brewery saw that, and they said, my gosh, you know, there's 84 cents a case deposit on long neck bottles, and they cost $2.50 a case. And they had a dilemma, and especially Budweiser, because as the returnable bottles got filled on the bottling line over a period of time, on the top shoulder of the bottle, they'd get real chalky and they'd have to be thrown away and replaced. Well, Miller and Slitz couldn't afford the new bottles, returnable bottles, so Budweiser was picking up the tab for all of them because they were interchangeable. So that's when they came out with this long neck, and it was a non-returnable bottle, and they put their A and Eagle on it to force the other breweries to come out and produce their own bottles. So then in the college markets, when the students were throwing away the bottles, they were non-returnable, which saved the brewery a lot of money.
On Grand Lake, is it true that you took a boat up there and drove around the lake with the Bud girls and all?
Well, I was able to, after 2 years, Frederick, my partner, his mother found out he was in the wholesale beer business and she wanted him to get out, so I was real fortunate. I was able to buy him out on a very attractive finance deal where I paid him, I think, so much a case, and also paid him rent for his half of the warehouse. I was able then also to buy the distributorship in Miami, which include Grand Lake. So my thoughts were, everybody's drinking Coors in Norman and Stillwater, and the college students would go home on the weekends or holidays, and they would convince all the high school seniors and their parents, everybody was drinking Coors. So my thought was, if we could get the college students in Norman and Stillwater to switch over to Budweiser, that was the secret. And I realized that the college students were hanging out at Grand Lake and Dripping Springs in the summertime. So if I could get those students at Dripping Springs to switch from Coors to Bud, that's the way we're going to get our share of the business. So we ran promotions for 12 years on Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day. And we had Budweiser boats. I had two boats. And on weekends, we would go over to Dripping Springs, and we had a band on one of the boats, and we had the Bud girls in Budweiser swimming suits, and we gave away hats, T-shirts, keychains, and all.
Did you give away beer? Did you give the beer away?
No, we didn't give any beer away.
Okay. But anyway, you've got that presence, and I believe the kind of boat was a Sea Ray Amberjack.
Right. Our first boat was a Webb craft.
Okay.
And Bill Webb helped us design it, and we had Budweiser on both sides of it, and Bill thought it'd be nice to put my name, Denny, on one side and Gail's on the other side. And so the first Budweiser boat, we sent a picture of it up to St. Louis, and August Bush saw it, and he thought it belonged to Denny Long, the president of Anheuser-Busch, and he jumped him out, and he said, "Did somebody give you a boat?" And no, that's not a, it was the wholesaler's boat. But we found out that we couldn't get quite enough beer on the Webb craft, so we were fortunate enough to buy a Amberjack, which was more a day cruiser that Sea Ray made for fishing. And we brought it to Grand Lake, and we had 22 accounts on the lake that sold beer, and we found out it was less expensive to deliver to those marinas by boat, especially on the east side of Grand Lake over by Big Hollow, where it was 12 miles from the highway between Jay and Grove on gravel roads to deliver the beer with the sharp rocks. It would blow out tires and everything. So we had plenty of volunteers to go out on Wednesday, go around, take the orders, and then we'd deliver the beer on Thursday to all the marinas. And one summer, my son John and his cousin David, they were the salesmen that went around on Wednesdays and picked up the orders, and they water skied at the same time, getting paid to write the orders. They got the water ski. But the Amberjack was mainly manufactured by Sea Ray for offshore fishing, and all of a sudden, because it was really a nice day cruiser, it was a 32-foot boat, Harbor's View Marina had sold 8 or 10 of these Amberjacks, and the factory called from Knoxville, and they thought that Pete and Jim Hauser were buying the boats and then bootlegging and selling them back to the coastal waters for fishing, and they said no, that it was actually for day cruising.
Yeah, and I have an Amberjack boat right now.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it I've had it for 12 to 15 years, and I've loved it, and you're the guy who brought Amberjack to Grand Lake.
That's correct.
Yeah, it's a great boat.
Yeah.
It's a great, great boat, right? But then you began to increase your territory, didn't you?
Yes, we had of course, Bartlesville and Miami, and then Jack and Dick Bryan had the Veneta, Claremore, Pryor territory that they serviced out of, with one man, one truck, out of Veneta back in the Coors heyday. And they sold me the Veneta territory, and then later, I was able to purchase the Lawton territory, Fort Sill, which was, by the way, 250 miles from the other end of the state. But a year later, I was able to purchase the Ardmore territory, which adjoined Lawton. So we had two pretty good-sized territories at each end of the state.
where your son John joins you in the business.
Yes, at that time, when John got graduated from college, I tried to get him a job with Anheuser-Busch, and we, after about a couple months, they did give John a job, and he ended up going to work for the Denver branch. Myself and some of the other Bud wholesalers were talking to St. Louis, and we thought it would be good for the children, young adults that were in the wholesaler family, to work a few years for the brewery so they would understand that side of the business. So John worked for 6 months in Denver, and I had lost my manager down in Ardmore and Lawton. He had moved to another distributorship in the southeast. So John came back and started in Ardmore, and then he also worked in Lawton. So he was managing the Lawton and the Ardmore distributorships.
And then you got into the Oklahoma City territory.
We were able to talk to the Brown family in Oklahoma City. Walt Brown, the owner, he retired, and his son, Mike, wasn't as interested in the beer business as his parents were, and they actually had a brewery rep managing the distributorship to help him out, and he liked to hunt and fish, and so they decided to sell the distributorship, and we negotiated a deal and eventually was able to purchase it. 90 days after we purchased it, Anheuser-Busch owned the Tulsa distributorship, and they asked to buy Northeast Oklahoma, which included the Bartlesville, Veneta, Miami, Grand Lake area, and I took Anheuser-Busch stock in the deal. And
so that was like in February 2000?
Yes, yes, that was
okay,
it.
Okay, I'll just say, so Premium Beers ended in February 2000.
Premium Beers in Northeast Oklahoma ended. It was a $500 corporation, and I took Anheuser-Busch stock, and it split two or three times after that. And I might mention that all during the 70s, I had all those other brands, and I had the original company was Northeast Distributing Company, and the Miller Brewing Company got bought out by Philip Morris in the 70s, and there were 8 Miller Budweiser wholesalers in the state, and the Miller people had introduced the Miller Ponies, the little 7-ounce bottles, and then they introduced Miller Lite, and their sales were coming on strong, and they thought they could overtake Anheuser-Busch. It didn't happen, but the Miller people wanted to get away from the Budweiser wholesalers in Oklahoma, and eventually Miller ended up over in all the other Miller warehouses, and Budweiser, the wholesalers, sold it. And it was probably a mistake for the Philip Morris people, where they thought that they could overtake Anheuser-Busch, and Anheuser-Busch was kind of a sleeping giant in those days, and they started a program called A Sense of Urgency, and Miller never did catch up with Anheuser-Busch, but they did get rid of all their Bud wholesalers in Oklahoma.
By purchasing them, you got rid of all their Bud wholesalers in Oklahoma.
All of us sold our Miller distributorships in that period around 1980. Miller introduced Miller Lite in the 70s, and they had bought a brewery in Chicago, Meisterbrau, and they had tried to introduce a light beer in Chicago back then, and it didn't go over. And when they introduced Miller Lite, they hired ex-NFL football players for the commercials, and they promoted less filling and slogans like that. And with football players drinking the light beer, it changed the image of light beer. But the other breweries didn't pay much attention to it. And it was a few years later, Anheuser-Busch introduced Budweiser Light, and it was a brand that they promoted running, bicycling, and it wasn't catching on. And the reason that it didn't, the word light was pretty generic, and people would go into a restaurant or a bar and say, give me a light, and everybody just assumed it was a Miller Lite. And in the 80s, I was on the Anheuser-Busch wholesaler panel for 3 years, and we had a meeting out in California, and August Bush asked all of his executives at that meeting to leave except his president and vice president of marketing. And then he started asking us, you know, what's wrong with Budweiser Light? And this man from, and actually he was an older man from Maine, the wholesaler had worked for the brewery, and he said, August, it's too stiff, it's stale, this, you know, bring out your best. He says, you got to make it funny, do something else. And so that gave him the idea of give me a light, and if somebody like had a cigar, they gave him a blowtorch to light his cigar, or they were sitting at the bar and say, give me a light, and the lightning would flash. So that's how they were able to start eating away at the Miller Lite brand. And of course today, Bud Light's the number one brand in the United States.